Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Now we're going to continue our series of conversations with the candidates. Maryland General Assembly District 41 has had more than its share of upheaval in recent years. Senator Lisa Gladden represented the district for 14 years before retiring in February of 2017 for health reasons. Delegate Nathaniel Oakes was appointed to fill her seat, and 4 months later, he was indicted in federal court on 9 counts of fraud and bribery. In November, prosecutors added obstruction of justice charges. Oakes denied the charges, remained in the Senate, and registered to run for re-election in the primary next month. In late March, Oakes changed his mind. He resigned from the legislature, he pleaded guilty, and attempted to remove his name from the primary ballot. Oakes will be sentenced on July 17th. He faces 8 to 10 years in prison. Additional attempts to remove Mr. Oakes' name from the ballot failed, and his name will appear next to those of 2 other candidates. Those 2 candidates are my guests right now. Until last week, Jill P. Carter served as the director of the Office of Civil Rights and Wage Enforcement in Baltimore City. Prior to that, she served for 3 terms in the House of Delegates representing the 41st District. Ms. Carter is 53 years old. She's a graduate of Western High School. She was born and raised in the city. She lives in the Hunting Ridge neighborhood of District 41. Ms. Carter, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
J.D. Merrill taught at his alma mater, City College High School, from 2013 to 16. He also served for 2 years as a special assistant to the chief of staff at City School headquarters on North Avenue. He's 27 years old. He and his wife, Grace O'Malley, live in the Windhurst neighborhood of Baltimore City. That's one street over from where he was born and raised. This is his first time running for public office. Mr. Merrill, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And further complicating matters, last week, Governor Larry Hogan appointed Ms. Carter to fill the remaining time in Senator Oakes's term. So, for the moment, Jill Carter is the incumbent senator from the 41st District, although the legislature is not in session. It will reconvene in January of next year. The winner of the primary in this race will not face any opposition in the general election in November. So we are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page, and later in the program, we'll try to take some of your questions and comments. That number here on Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. So, Ms. Carter, it's a sad day in Maryland politics with the death of County Executive Kevin Kamenetz. Let me ask first for your reflections on that.
Well, thank you for asking. I do want to express my deep sympathy to the family, staff, supporters, to his running mate, Valerie Irvin, and every other person that's impacted by this tragic and untimely death. It's been startling to me and many people today. My experience with Kevin Kamenetz was somewhat limited politically, but I can speak fondly about our recent encounters. The first is that he did attend our civil rights breakfast when I was a new director with the Office of Civil Rights, and we had conversations that I can only share that I felt comfortable that he was evolving in his thinking about law enforcement reform. And so we were working on that somewhat together. I think it's a tragic loss, and it's going to impact Baltimore County and the state of Maryland for some time to come.
And J.D. Merrill, did you know Mr. Kamenetz, and what are your thoughts now?
Yeah, well, it's certainly a sad day for Baltimore and for the region. When I was at City Schools and we were going through the $130 million budget crisis, the county executive sent his staff to the district office to learn the challenges that we were facing. And it seemed that he had a unique understanding of the importance of a regional approach to improving public education. You know, he didn't just invest in public schools in Baltimore County. He really seemed to have an understanding for the challenges we are facing in city schools. And as a candidate for governor, seemed to be putting our children and families at the forefront of his campaign and in his mind. So, you know, my heart today and my thoughts are with his family and his sons. And it's a very sad day for all of us.
Jill Carter, let's talk a little bit about the series of events that led to your being appointed by Governor Hogan to fill the remainder of the term of Nathaniel Oakes, who, as I mentioned, has resigned from the Senate. Your opponent, Mr. Merrill, who's sitting right here, thought it would be better that neither of you be considered or appointed to that position. Let the voters decide in June, which is essentially deciding the race, because whoever wins will not face an opponent in November. You took a different view. You placed your name in nomination. the Democratic Central Committee was not able to agree on a candidate. They voted 2-2 on 5 separate occasions, and so they ended up sending both names, yours and one other, to the governor and let him decide. Why did you make that decision?
I made the right decision. First of all, we need someone to fill the seat and represent the district, someone that's qualified. People decided at the ballot at least 3 times previously, where I was the delegate serving the district and where I enjoyed the highest number of votes of any delegate, including more than the previous senator in the last election. So I do think that I was the most logical choice for the governor to select. I also believe that it was a little disingenuous for my opponent to claim that no one that could actually hold the seat long term should fill it, because I think that that was based on the fact that he probably wasn't able to coerce the members of the district, the central committee, to vote for him, and certainly neither was I. So it was really a decision that was just anyone's guess who it would be, but I think that the governor made the right decision. And as it stands now, I'm hitting the ground running. I'm doing outreach to get about $50,000 in scholarships awarded that wouldn't be done if we didn't have someone filling the seat right now. And I'm also working to bring the district together in sort of a district-wide summit so we can do some healing and collaborating on what issues we should come together and pursue in the future, both during this period and in the next legislative session.
All right, Mr. Merrill, your response.
Yeah, well, I'd say that the senator is absolutely right. I was not interested in coercing a group of 6 individuals to select me as the next state senator. I have trust and faith in the people of the district that they will make their choice between Senator Carter and myself at the ballot box in June. And for my part, you know, as a former teacher and administrator, I understand the importance of showing up and working hard every day. Our campaign has knocked on over 25,000 doors since announcing my candidacy in January. We're going to continue to listen to the people of the district, and I feel very optimistic that they're going to choose our campaign on June 26.
Ms. Carter, there are those who questioned your judgment when you were the head of the Office of Civil Rights and Wage Enforcement in the city. You left the House of Delegates to go to work for Mayor Pugh. She was able to convince you to leave that seat to come to work for the city. But a gentleman named Charles G. Byrd, Jr. Was hired in February to do a number of things as the deputy director of the Office of Civil Rights. He overlooked the Civilian Review Board and other areas that are of great importance and very much front of mind, given what's been going on with the Baltimore City Police Department, et cetera. And then it came to light after some investigative reporting by the Baltimore Sun that Mr. Byrd had been disbarred. He's a lawyer by training, as are you. He had been disbarred. And originally you alluded to the fact that you didn't think his disbarment would disqualify him from serving in that office. You want to explain what that situation is about?
Absolutely. So personally, professionally, and legislatively, I am on record as believing in second chances and believing that we assess and judge people based on their qualifications and their abilities and their performance. And so that is exactly what I did. I did give great weight to the decision to hire him as deputy director. He far outweighed all other applicants. But in addition to that, he was doing a wonderful job for the office. When I took over as director, the agency had a lot of struggles. There was a lot of new staff and a lot of personnel changes. And we really needed to fill the positions with qualified people that had experience. He had over 30 years experience litigating cases both in law enforcement and discrimination. There was no one that could touch that.
But the Maryland Bar Association disbarred him for misappropriating funds from his clients.
Right.
So is he a trustworthy person?
So he was trustworthy for the purposes that we had. I mean, in our office, he wasn't handling money, and I was the ultimate decision maker on the cases that were being investigated and the ultimate decisions on the results of those cases. And we were beginning to have a lot of success in that office. The Civilian Review Board, for one, had long gone without having any real impact, and we were beginning to make a difference in cases in people's lives. Calvin Wilkes' case and Keith Davis' case are cases that we were able to sustain findings where there had been no prior suspension. And so we were also making progress in our discrimination cases. And so I stand by the belief that it was a smart decision at the time. There is a criminal background check that happens that he passed because there were no criminal charges that resulted of his disbarment. There was no restitution owed. And so these things were checked out. Our staff today is somewhat devastated by the loss of him and me now, maybe temporarily. We're not really sure how that's going to go. But I just honestly believe that the disbarment was not, should not have been a factor to disqualify him from the office. In fact, I was the only barred person in the office. So being a lawyer, a practicing lawyer, is not a requirement. And so to me, to let the skill, the qualification just go to waste would have been more tragic. He decided to resign because he felt that now that this had come, been made a media spectacle, that he would be distracting from the mission of the office. And so he chose to leave. And so I give him credit for that as well.
And J.D. Merrill, you come to politics through education. You're a Teach for America, and then you worked at North Avenue, as I mentioned. There are those who support Ms. Carter who say, you know, the district has had such an upheaval with Senator Gladden leaving and then Nathaniel Oaks coming in and really abusing the privilege of his office in a horrendous way, that now is the time for an experienced hand. So Ms. Carter did represent the district for three terms prior to leaving to go to work for the city. Why should voters turn away from a person who knows the terrain and who's done it before, particularly at a time where stability seems to be something that's of importance to the voters in the district?
Sure. I certainly understand that concern. I taught for 3 years at Baltimore City College. In my second year of teaching, I led an effort that raised $2.2 million to build a new library for our school. In that work, I had to bring together a diverse coalition to raise funds to support our children, to improve our school. And the first year after that new library opened, student achievement went up by 158%. So inspired by what I saw as the potential of our young people, that when given access to opportunity, they succeed, I went to the district office, where I had to help the district navigate a $130 million budget crisis. And I realized that the greatest opportunity in a generation is before us with the Kerwin Commission to significantly improve our schools, not just across Baltimore, but across the region and across Maryland. And I think that the perspective of former teachers needs to be at the table when these important decisions are made about the future of our education system. I believe I have the experience and the qualities necessary to bring our district together after being underrepresented for so long. The truth is that when Ms. Carter was in the House of Delegates, she missed over 1,600 votes. She brought home the worst attendance record of any member of the Baltimore City delegation for 7 of those 14 years. And I think that we need to bring a new leadership into the district that's going to bring us together, work hard, and show up every day on behalf of our children and families.
So the so-called hit the ground running argument, meaning that if you were to be elected, you'd be a brand new freshman legislator in Annapolis. It would take you some period of time to figure out how that particular machine, operates. You don't accept that argument.
Certainly. Well, it will certainly take me some time to figure out where the bathrooms are and get acquainted with the halls of Annapolis. But I've always been a quick learner. I've always been a leader and someone who steps up to get the job done. And the importance of this moment for public education and the urgency that I'm bringing to this race to improve the quality of our schools is something that I think will carry me well into the Maryland General Assembly and the State Senate. And the truth is, look, both Ms. Carter and I will be sitting in the back row, whether she's elected or I'm elected. Both of us will be first-time senators. And I think that I have tremendous upside that will benefit our district and our children well.
And Ms. Carter, your legislative priorities, clearly Mr. Merrill is very focused on education as the 2019 session comes upon us in 6 months or so. What are going to be the top priorities for you?
Well, first I'm going to respond to Mr. Merrill's allegation, his distortion of my legislative record. First of all, over the years that I was there, even the number of votes that he claims that I missed amounts to less than 7% of all votes on the floor that were taken. In addition to that, the questions that should be asked, and this ties into what my legislative priorities will be, is not what did I miss, but where was everyone else when I was fighting to get the lead out of the water in the schools? Where was everyone else when I was fighting to get independent trial boards? Where was everyone else when I was fighting for bail reform about 8 years before it became popular? Where was everyone else when I was fighting for criminal justice reform and expungement legislation 10 years ago? And that is what is important. That's the type of visionary leadership that I bring. The fact that before many of the so-called priorities now were popular, I was already fighting for them. And so I've got organic ties to the district, but I also have support of advocacy groups. I've been endorsed by the AFL-CIO, the SEIU, the Maryland Working Families, and yeah. others.
And the questions you raise are certainly valid, but the questions Mr. Merrill raises as well, I mean, if most other legislators were making these votes, whether it's 7% or less than that even, maybe one of the questions is, where were you when those votes took place? I mean, are there particular reasons that you were not participating
in
those votes?
I don't accept his perception of whatever the votes were. And I don't even know, because I haven't taken time they've spent tens of thousands of dollars doing so-called opposition research on me to come up with these numbers. I have never enjoyed that type of financing for campaigns. But the point is, I don't specifically know, but I know this. I know that there were over 3,500 votes in the House Judiciary Committee, and I was regularly there. I know that I think, and I'm not sure what this attendance thing is, but I think it could be talking about delegation meetings, which there were many years that I didn't go to delegation meetings regularly, because they're just meetings where you just hear about issues. But for the most part, when his father-in-law, Governor O'Malley, was the mayor and then the governor, the delegation was usually not with me on the very issues that I was talking about. There was no support for my legislation. And so it seemed like I could spend my time doing other things, like working with organizations like Mothers of Murdered Sons and working to actually use my bandwidth to actually make an impact on issues that mattered, as opposed to attending like delegation meetings that really weren't going to matter. But I can also say that there were issues over 14 years that caused you to miss time. The last year, I didn't want to discuss this, but the last year that I was there, I was excused for most of the time because my mother was sick and dying, and she did die at the end of that session. Over the other period of 14 years, there were numerous things that happened in your life personally, or maybe again, I was sitting with Miss Brown or the Barnes family when their child went missing, or when Christopher Brown was murdered. I established relationships with people, and I fought for their issues, but it was also important to not just be there like Pavlov's dog pushing buttons all the time on things that may or may not matter.
I would finally
posit that there is no time that I missed anything where it changed the outcome. So thank you.
And Ms. Merrill, I mean, obviously a state senator has a lot on his or her mind. There's a lot of competing interests and stuff. And is it a fair criticism to take, you know, a number of votes and make a percentage, whether it's accurate or not, and use that as a metric for a legislator's effectiveness? Obviously, your judgment and how you use your time is a matter of individual judgment, is it not?
Sure, Tom. Let me just first say that Senator Carter has my deepest condolences for the loss of her mother, who was a lifelong city school teacher and, by all accounts, an admirable woman. I did not spend thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars doing this research. All her voting records is accessible to the public for free on Maryland Legislative Watchdog's website. And we did this research after going to community meetings and hearing from community leaders that Senator Carter, as delegate, did not consistently come to their neighborhood meetings. And we wondered, if she wasn't showing up in neighborhoods, was she showing up to work in Annapolis?
You're talking about meetings, not votes.
Correct. And so we did the research to see what her record was in Annapolis. These were all floor votes. These weren't delegation. These weren't committee votes. These were all floor votes. And this is a pattern of behavior over 14 years that showed that she consistently missed votes. And many votes were important to Maryland's working families. Senator Carter says that, you know, she's the people's champion. She's the voice for the voiceless.
No, they say.
The expression of people's voice in Annapolis is the vote. And to not do the fundamental act of legislating by voting on issues, I think, is important to Maryland families.
All right. Well, I'm going to be impeached myself if I don't take a break right now. So
I'm so happy they supported me. They endorsed me. Yeah, I'm working families.
All right. We will come back and have more with our two guests. This is another in our series of continuing series of conversations with the candidates. My guest here in Studio A, J.D. Merrill and Jill P. Carter. They are Democrats. They are running in the primary for the Senate seat in District 41 that has been vacated by former Senator Nathaniel Oaks. We'll have more with Mr. Merrill and Ms. Carter when we come back after a break. We are streaming on the Facebook page WIPR. We are accepting calls and comments at 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. And by the way, we have just received word that tonight's gubernatorial debate at UMBC has been canceled. This is, of course, because of the death of one of the candidates in that race, Kevin Kamenetz. It will now be a memorial vigil for Mr. Kamenetz. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, we were going to speak with Prince George's County Executive Rashern Baker, who is running for governor. But of course, with the sudden passing of Baltimore County Executive and fellow gubernatorial candidate Kevin Kamenetz, we have been in touch with the Baker campaign, and we've decided to postpone Mr. Baker's appearance on our show until next week. He will be here on Friday, May 18th. So instead, tomorrow, we will welcome Dr. Lena Wen back to the program. She is the Baltimore City Health Commissioner and part of our regular feature called the Midday Health Watch. That's coming up tomorrow. If you're just joining us today, my guests are the two Democratic candidates running for the Maryland Senate seat in District 41 here in Baltimore City. The district encompasses Roland Park in the northeast to over by the Reisterstown Road Plaza in the northwest, all the way down to Hunting Ridge and Edmondson Village in the southwest portion of our city. Senator Jill P. Carter was recently named by Governor Larry Hogan to complete the term of Nathaniel Oakes, the disgraced legislator who resigned his seat and pled guilty to fraud charges in March. Although his name remains on the ballot, Oakes will be sentenced in July and will not be eligible to serve in the Senate. J.D. Merrill is a former teacher and administrator in the Baltimore City Public Schools. Both candidates bring a familial pedigree to politics. Ms. Carter is the daughter of the civil rights activist Walter P. Carter. Mr. Merrill is the son-in-law of former Governor Martin O'Malley. Again, the winner of this primary will not face a challenger in the November general election. You are welcome to join our conversation. We have a lot of folks on the phone. I will do my darndest to get to as many as we can. And of course, priority will be given to listeners who live in the 41st District. 410-662-8780 to send us an email, midday at WYPR.org, and to send us a tweet at midday WYPR. Mrs. Hartnett, rather, writes in a question for both of you. Ms. Carter, what do you stand for specifically, and which policies on education do you support? And then Mr. Merrill, for you, it's wonderful that you raised $2.2 million for a library, but to me, that just means that you know a lot of people with a lot of money. They raised that money and built that library. So what else have you done? Tell us who you are. So Jill Carter, let's start with you. When it comes to education specifically, the Kerwin Commission, for example, is about to release their findings. What kind of formula are you looking for when the Kerwin Commission makes its recommendation to the legislature?
Thank you. Well, the first part of the question was what kind of policies would I advocate even beyond education? And I think it's clear that the type of legislator that I was and will be.
Well, the question is on this. This question is specifically about education.
So, to champion issues for people, one of them that was always important to me was education equity. And so, I'm very thankful for the Kerwin Commission recommendations. It's going to be incumbent upon the legislature and legislators, particularly from Baltimore City, the Baltimore delegation, to advocate very strenuously and vigilantly for funding formulas that are equitable for our system that has been unconstitutional. Underfunded.
Can you give us an idea what those formulas could look like, as the commission has yet to issue its report?
So the commission is still trying to come up with, I think, formulas and also sources of funding, even though we're thankful that the lockbox bill was passed and hopefully the voters will approve it. And over the next 5 years, all monies from casinos and gambling will go to it. And so I can only say that the formulas under even Thornton, still the court decided were still not adequate for Baltimore. And so I think that we just have to ensure that whatever they are, they don't take, for example, one of the bills that passed this year, too, was a step in the right direction to not allow development deals that have tax incremental financing to be included in our calculation for wealth. And so we have to make sure that Baltimore City, having the highest concentration of poverty, is actually treated fairly, and not just fairly like for all fairness across the board, but that we receive actually reparation funding for what has been an apartheid funding system for our school system.
All right, J.D. Merrill, what should the Kerwin Commission, in your view, try to accomplish with a new formula that would replace what's known as the Thornton formula, which has been in place for more than a decade?
Sure. Well, I think the first point is that under Thornton, we've been underfunded by $290 million. And under an initial report from the Kerwin Commission, city schools has been underfunded by $358 million and statewide $2.9 billion. So the Kerwin Commission really has to accomplish two things. One, it has to fully fund Baltimore City Public Schools, and it has to create a funding structure that accomplishes that and ensures it for decades and generations to come. The second thing is we have to align our policy with international best practice. We need to expand early childhood education to three-year-olds. We have to improve the teaching profession, teacher professional development, and treat them like the professionals that they are. We have to expand and enrich our curriculum beyond just literacy and math. Art, music, drama, after-school activities, sports all have to be a part of the core experience in our schools. We need to provide more resources for our students. We have a 1 to 900 guidance counselor ratio in city school. How can you possibly provide guidance to 900 kids as one person? We need wraparound services. We need school-based health centers. And we also have to improve our governance and accountability of the way we do public education here in the state. And the Kerwin Commission needs to accomplish all of those things, and I think they will.
And folks might say, well, all of those things are all well and good and very expensive. What's your notion about how to pay for it?
Sure. Well, I'd say that this is a great opportunity for us to bring together a bipartisan and diverse coalition across the state. You know, for too long, folks from other parts of the state have viewed Baltimore as a drain on the state's resources. But with Kerwin and with a statewide reimagination of public education, we have the opportunity to join forces with legislators on the Eastern Shore. There are three counties on the Eastern Shore where 96% of kids live in concentrations of poverty. Western Maryland has experienced similar job loss to what we've experienced. Here's an opportunity to join hands with Republican legislators and other rural legislators and urban legislators in Montgomery County and Prince George's County and say, let's create a national model for what school funding and policy can look like. And I think that's what we'll do.
Let's try to go to the phones and get a couple of calls. Eric, you're calling from District 41. Welcome to Midday with Jill P. Carter and J.D. Merrill.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I have a multiple-part question, and I kind of want to preface it beforehand. And so the beginning part is for J.D. So with that being said, so as a ex-military officer, right, I would not expect to lead, you know, a strike group or a large level command without the experience, you know, from the ground up. And, you know, also if you look at it in a firm structure in corporate America, I wouldn't look for a C-suite without, you know, having that, you know, same experience from the ground up. So I guess I'm trying to get an understanding of what have you done other than education, you know, that makes you think you're qualified for, you know, this position.
All right, let's start there.
Yeah. Thank you for your question, Eric, and thank you for your service to our country. You know, I'd start by saying that I think that our teachers across Baltimore City Public Schools are perhaps the most experienced and qualified people to run for office. I was a high school history and government teacher, and I think that the idea that I was qualified to teach about our government but not serve in it is a little bit silly. You know, as a teacher, you have to be knowledgeable in a wide range of content areas, and you have to be willing to listen and learn from your students about a wide range of topics. You know, I saw the impact of an inadequate transportation system every time that a kid came to school late. You know, I felt the impact of gun violence every time a student came to my classroom and talked about a loved one who was lost. And teachers understand the importance of showing up and working hard every single day. And I think that those are the qualities that make excellent legislators. And I bring the urgency to this work of knowing that we need to get something done for our kids if we're going to have this generation have a chance to earn a living wage and grow in strength in the middle class.
And just a few days ago, City College suffered the loss of another student. Very, very sad. Jill Carter, here's a tweet from Maya, who says, what are your plans for criminal justice? There were a couple of bills that went through the legislature this past session. One was called SB 122, which was very much concerned with mandatory minimum sentences and increasing sentences. That was watered down somewhat in terms of what ended up passing. What do you think the state legislature, the Senate in particular, should accomplish when it comes to violence reduction?
So thank you for the question, Maya. Basically, I believe in the philosophy of de-incarceration, of providing programs, opportunities, and resources and diversionary programs to prevent incarceration wherever possible. Many of the people that are subject to our criminal justice system, especially coming from Baltimore City, originated from lead-poisoned backgrounds, from poor schools that failed them, and from lack of opportunity, and from disinvestment in their neighborhoods, their schools, and their communities. And so those are the kinds of things that, as a senator, I will work to ensure that we provide resources and opportunities. As a legislator, believe it or not, as a House of, in the House of Delegates, my committee in the early years would joke with me and give me erasers because they said that I wanted to erase records, but I didn't. I wanted to give opportunities to people and have automatic expungement for non-convictions. I want to also provide an opportunity to have people that have served their time and pay their debt to society to not be stained eternally by a criminal record. And so we have things to do on both ends by allowing more opportunities to expunge.
Should repeat felons who use guns in crimes be incarcerated for longer periods of time? Because that's really the question that the legislature ended up answering.
Expanding incarceration does not do anything to prevent violence or ensure that when they come back into society, which they will, because we have no death penalty, and we never had a death penalty for gun crimes. So I believe two things. I believe that we need to prosecute people and get convictions on crimes that they commit, and that having a gun as a as an additional way to cause people to plead guilty, which happens far too often, and using the gun as a tool to get a conviction because a conviction cannot be obtained on the more serious crime. I think that's a backwards way of thinking that we have to change. What I believe is that we should have specific programs and services, diversion, alternate dispute resolution, and all kinds of things to rehabilitate people to get them prepared to come back to society to reduce violence.
And Mr. Merrill, your approach to criminal justice and violence reduction.
Sure. So I clearly got into this race because of public education. But I learned very quickly at my first door I knocked that public safety is on everyone's minds. And there's sort of two crises that we're facing with public safety right now. One is of trust and one is of effectiveness. I was at the Garwin Oaks community meeting and a woman said, I used to not call the police because I thought they wouldn't show up. And now I won't call the police because I'm scared of what will happen if they do show up. That's a scary reflection on where we are right now as a society when it comes to policing and public safety. And I think the state has to take a more proactive approach. I agree with Senator Carter that we need to expand expungement legislation. I agree that mandatory minimums, the research suggests, are not an effective deterrent to criminals. But I think that the state needs to do more to connect our inmates to job training and education services so that we can reduce recidivism and so that when folks are leaving our system, they're able to get a job, get housing, and get back to work.
I'm afraid we're going to have to call it a day there, but I'm very grateful to both of you for coming in and being on the program. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
J.D. Merrill and Jill P. Carter are Democrats running for the state Senate in District 41. The winner of the primary will not face a Republican opponent in the general election in November. Nathaniel Oakes resigned from this seat in March. He has pleaded guilty to corruption charges. He'll be sentenced in July. Mr. Oakes' name will appear on the ballot in the primary next month. To be clear, if by some chance voters elect him, he will not be seated in the legislature. The primary is June 26th. Early voting begins in 36 days on June 14th. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen. We'll also air an interview I recorded yesterday with Jack Everly, the principal pops conductor of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, about the concerts that he's conducting this weekend at the Meyerhoff. We want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features a variety of sandwiches and salads, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening.